possibility of us using climate change as a positive stimulus to help us move forward in adopting new policies and technologies in certain areas. So in that sense, it's very vital. Obviously, we're going to hear mostly from different departments today because clearly we're looking at all areas of human endeavor where climate change impacts, and many of those issues clearly do not fall within the mandate of DEA. It falls within other specific departments. So we will come and hear from those departments what it is they're doing to realize the adaptation objectives we have as a nation. We will start off with a brief input, well, not a brief, but input from DEA, just to set the stage for us, basically, of some of the things I've said now around adaptation before we move to the specific departments. Is anyone wanting to raise anything before we start the meeting? Thank you. Right. Ms. Beaumont, whoever is speaking today, start by introducing yourself so that people know, particularly Mr. Mateba likes to know who he's listening to.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. My name is Tsepo Moremi. I'm the Chief Director for Climate Change Adaptation in the Department of Environmental Affairs. I'm going to present the work on what is called the long-term adaptation scenario that we want to develop for South Africa. But I'm going to touch not on the details, because this work is actually linked to what SANBI will be doing in the next 2 years as part of the adaptation flagship program. So I'll just touch on the stakeholder consultation, the main products, what we intend to deliver, and then Professor Guy Mekwi, he will unpack those thematic areas. And then I'll also touch on the policy alignment work of sector departments that we need to do as well. And then the last presentation, which is more information, is going to be on the municipal toolkit that we have developed as a department for local government. Thank you, Chair. In terms of the National Climate Change Response Policy, as it relates to adaptation, the objective there is to effectively manage inevitable climate change impacts through important interventions that build and sustain South Africa's social, economic, and environmental resilience and emergency response. So most of the work that we focus on is not only on the natural sciences, but the interventions that we want to do are mainly social, economic, and environmental as well, and how do we respond to emergencies. The deliverables for the next two years are stipulated by the policy. It instructs us to do a research for long-term adaptation scenarios, focusing, the list is not exclusive, but these are the sectors that have been identified by the white paper, which is water, agriculture, commercial forestry, biodiversity and ecosystem. And to just to indicate, biodiversity and ecosystem also includes oceans and coastal management, and then human settlement, which is urban, rural, and oceans as well, health, disaster risk reduction and management. Then the policy also says we need to do a policy alignment into these sectors. Now, with regard to the long-term adaptation scenario for South Africa, which is called the LTAS, I'll be using the word LTAS. Its intention is to project and evaluate the socio-economic and environmental implications of potential impacts of anticipated climate change. then long term, which is mid-century, 2050-2055, up to the end of the century, as dependent on the latest range of IPCC business as usual forcing scenarios, and also as required by the White Paper. Now, it's got a number of objectives. The first one being that we need to quantify in socio-economic terms where feasible the potential impact of a common set of climate change scenarios on key sectors, public goods, and sustainable development goals over three policy relevant time frames that I've alluded to. Second one being that to identify key adaptation responses and strategies relevant to all three time frames and assess their potential effectiveness over each time frame in terms of their effectiveness, in terms of their feasibility, implementation costs, mitigation implications, avoided damages, and additional benefits. Other one being that to identify adaptation gaps and opportunities that require research, development, and capacity building to increase resilience to climate change over all the three time frames. Now, to use integrated assessment approaches where feasible to identify potential key cross-sectoral impacts and related adaptation policy and planning implications of anticipated climate change. Also to enhance coherence and synergy in adaptation planning and approaches in South Africa. And this is very important because we want to close the gap in terms of the fragmentation that has been existing, and we need to synergize and bring coherence in the adaptation planning in South Africa. Now, to conduct an assessment of climate change vulnerabilities in the sub-region with a detailed scenario planning process to define potential sub-regional response strategies. Ms. Newman indicated yesterday, as an example, using water as an example, that for an example, we get water from Lesotho. If anything happens to that water, that will definitely impact on most of us. Environment knows no borders. And in future, South Africa, as an example, is planning to get hydroelectricity from the DRC. So it is very important also to do assessment in the sub-region and also to do climate scenarios for the sub-region because they are commonalities. Now, to develop information products for policymakers about climate change impact, risk, and appropriate adaptation goals and investment needs relating to alternative global mitigation goals. Now, these are the main products that within 2 years we need to have, products that we need to have developed. One is climate change scenarios, and these products will be unpacked later by Sandy in more detail. Climate change impact scenarios, adaptation response options and opportunities, economic modeling of impact costs, and cost and avoided damages of adaptation, and special explicit products on the SARVA platform. Now, SARVA is a South African Risk and Vulnerability Atlas that has been developed by Department of Science and Technology, which actually is a GIS product that identifies risk areas within the country. Now, we want to use this product on the SARVA platform that synthesizes adaptation guidelines and potential adaptation response plans and make them available in all the special scales and then the sub-regional assessment report for climate scenarios. I won't go into detail because Professor Migley is actually going to give you the actual time frames, but in the first phase, basically, in 2012-2011, we're going to do climate scenarios for all the sectors. Now, this is a set of scenarios that represent an expert consensus, which is necessary for comparable analysis of impact and vulnerability between key sectors. And this will represent a key step forward in a holistic assessment of coherent adaptation scenarios for South Africa. Secondly, we're going to identified for this year, the, not that other sectors are not important, but they will be factored in the next year. But for this year, the sectors that we are going to focus on is agriculture, water, and health. And then also do an identification of adaptation responses for biodiversity, agriculture, water, and health, and then do the economic scenario for biodiversity. And we're going to use this economic scenario as a baseline for to pilot possible approaches for other sectors as well. Now, in the second phase, basically, we will be focusing on the, in 2013, 2014, we'll be focusing on the remaining sectors by conducting impact and economic scenario work on the remaining sectors, and then conduct avoided damages, which is your economic analysis on all sectors to allow an overall assessment of economic cost-benefit of climate change adaptation responses. The second phase will terminate with an overall synthesis on adaptation scenarios undertaken in both phases and a translation of key information into a format suitable for dissemination on the SARWA platform.
Explain this to us a bit more carefully. Again, it worries me in the words that you put it, that somehow we have to find, look at all the adaptation scenarios before we start moving on things. That's how it comes across. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't prepare, we shouldn't do things, but, you know, for example, you have to explain to us then how the flagship programs fit into that. Because they're there, governments agree to them. Obviously, they have to be given some life, some body, and so on. But I mean, you know, if one of them is, say, the renewable energy, there's a policy being adopted to get to renewable energy. Now, it doesn't seem to me you're going to have to sit and do huge scenarios and so on. I mean, you may have to do on the efficacy of which renewables we would want to move to, what we would like to emphasize and so on, but that is there already. So I think you must try and explain to us, when you explain it like this, what happens to things that are already there and already happening as to new things you may want? Because, I mean, the problem is that most of the stuff in the white paper are really agreed to and they're there. They aren't new things. So, you know, I'm a little bit worried with going this phase one and then phase two, although you have given some explanation that you concentrate on these three and do this and those two, you'll do that and that. So they're already making a differentiation and asymmetry there. But I do want you just to explain that a bit more before we get to the individual departments, how you are seeing it as a department.
Okay. Can I ask, Chair, that we park that question until we have done also the adaptation research flagship?
No. You must understand. I mean, if you can't explain it to me now, then we're in trouble.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, and good morning, Honourable Members. I think the point is very well taken, that what we've got to focus on is the action right now, and it's the immediate action. And in fact, that is the thinking that has been, I think, presented yesterday, that we build on what exists. And in fact, one of the principles, or one of the elements of the strategic approach that I presented yesterday, was exactly that we have the immediate implementation, recognizing that climate change and climate variability is happening as we speak. We are already seeing increased intensity of thunderstorms, for example, in Gauteng, increased or lengthened drought events in certain areas. So the thinking around the long-term adaptation scenarios is, in a similar way to the mitigation work, that we build on the implementation work now of what is happening. Now, interestingly, in the policy document, there are only three, I think, out of the eight flagship programs that have an explicit adaptation focus, and that is the Water Conservation and Demand Management flagship program. It is the Adaptation Research Flagship Program, which Sandy will take us through. And then thirdly, it is the EPWP, the Expanded Public Works, the Working for Water, the Working for Fire, the Working for Coast, the various Working for programs. And I think what will be interesting when we hear from Guy Preston this afternoon is that those Working for programs, although not actually defined and conceptual and designed and conceptualized initially as adaptation programs, the outcome is very explicitly an adaptation outcome in the sense that there is conservation, significant conservation of water, there's significant management of fire outcomes. So that's an example of where we are recognizing that there is explicit work underway. In the agriculture sector, I personally think that there is space for a flagship program that starts focusing on some of the agriculture, explicit agriculture work that is happening that has an adaptation response. So the long-term planning scenarios is to give us the forward-looking trajectory, really, and really enable us to understand in a level of detail that we have not understood before, of what the vulnerabilities are in the agriculture sector, in the water sector, in the various sectors that have been identified, so that we're able to do, rather than a piecemeal adaptation response, which I think is happening currently, and I don't want to underestimate the positive impact of that piecemeal work, but yet it is not tied together under an overarching planning framework which says this is where we're going, these are the vulnerabilities, this is the risk, this is the potential cost, and this is what we need to do in order to respond.
Well, that's a perfect answer. The problem is you guys must explain it. The problem is we start like this. The main product is a climate change scenario, is a climate change impact scenario. And then the next slide you say, now this is how it's going to take place. Then the impression that's left is not all the things that you've explained now. Clearly you need to say that this is what we'll be doing. There's a reality on the ground and we still be dealing with this. But what we're going to try and do is a parallel process where we try and then integrate all this. And as these other ones take place, hopefully as we get more clued up, we'll start seeing where those ones are all right or where we need to tweak them and change them. And I mean, we need to explain that in that way, because that is how it needs to be understood. Because if you say it like this, there's a one phase and a second phase, and then it really creates that impression. This is a long-term scenario. We're going to sit for ages and ages sitting, working these things out to be a country that does things in a reasonable way, and that's fine. There's no problem with it. It's not a criticism. It has to be done. But the problem is you can't ignore reality, and that's there. In fact, not only a reality, I mean, they're like flagship programs that have been approved by cabinet, and there's budgets attached to it. So you need to say, there's this reality, there's these scenarios. So how do we explain both of them, and then how do we then say how are we going to start dealing with the two of them to become one? So that our next generation will be able to then just deal with your, you know, fitting things into that. So you guys must explain. I mean, you explained it perfectly, Ms. Bowman, but I mean, that needs to be set down in writing, and we need to make sure that that's the way we look at it, okay? All right, I understand now what the answer is, okay? Go ahead.
And that would be unpacked a little bit more later also.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, in terms of stakeholder engagement, stakeholder engagement is actually central to achieving the aims of the LTAF and will serve two main purposes. One, providing information on progress on the LTAF process and obtaining feedback to guide necessary shifts in approach as necessary, testing the relevance and feasibility of adaptation guidance products by requesting feedback through an expert interactive workshop process. Also by gathering information on expert sector-specific thinking on practical done through the technical working group and then which will provide oversight and guidance on policy relevance of technical work and then alignment with international standards and issues relating to adaptation. And then the technical working group will also do balance of information with respect to sustainable development and other policy imperatives. And probably that's what you, the chair has been talking about. And then it will involve inclusiveness of participation and then comprehensiveness of stakeholder consultation. Now, the adaptation technical working group, if it's important, we might still break it further into some legal task teams to focus on specific areas like your important economic sectors, agriculture, forestry, tourism, and water, as an example, your social sectors, health, human settlement, disaster management, livelihoods, and then your natural resources sectors like your land, biodiversity, and conservation, water.
Why don't we, the two most important, energy and transport, why don't we see them as adaptation? I know that at the moment there's a lot of mitigation things there, but I would imagine for me, as a country, if I want to look at where will I make the biggest impact with adaptation, will be transport and energy. I mean, if you add, you know, if you do proper, so, you know, they're not even listed here in the sectoral task teams. So I'm aware that one of you said, I think Ms. Bowman said that clearly, it's not a clear-cut thing, this is adaptation, this is mitigation. I'm quite clear on that. But it would imagine for me that we're being short-sighted if we, even if we're mainly looking at energy and transport as mitigation at the moment, but clearly in our future and our long-term planning, the most important adaptation is where the most carbon is being generated. That's energy and transport. So it would seem to me that, I mean, we should put them, as far as adaptation is concerned, like on a pedestal and completely in a different category, because that is where we really want to push the energy people to think on new technologies, new adaptation, because, I mean, they generate 70% of the carbon. So if we can get them to come up with real new technologies and adaptation, like the renewable flagship, but that kind of thing even more deeply and more of the energy efficiency, then that's going to be the even bigger impact. So I really want us to engage on that. I'm sure some of the members will ask questions as well, but it seems to me that we must be careful that we don't. I've said to you, there's a reality we can't ignore, but also by looking into the future, we shouldn't be bound by the reality only and say, well, at the moment there may not be adaptation or that much adaptation in energy, and but clearly in our thinking, I mean, they should really be committees on their own that look at and give, be given priority in terms of where we want to move, surely. But I'll let people ask. You don't have to respond to that. I just see they're not here. And we'll also let it come out in question time. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that is a very important point there. And I think it's noted, Chair, that input will be taken into consideration. And I can't agree with you more. And actually, if you look into human settlement or infrastructure development, electricity supply, for an example, will definitely have an adaptive approach. The building of roads, provision of solar systems and so on, is electricity, but it's adaptation as well. So those are the things. I think...
And makes other adaptations more viable.
Exactly.
In human settlements, if you can, if you look, if you have got constrictions in terms of electricity and water, then human settlement adaptation can only, it's limited. So you can't really look at all possibilities. Limited by certain things. And so the better we get in the things that create restrictions like energy and water and things, the better we are there, the more opportunities we get in these other areas of safe human settlements. I mean, if you've got good renewable projects, then you can start thinking of, even if you build RDP houses, to what extent can you do that? If you're going to have to rely on just ESCOM and so on, well, there's limitations there to it. And it limits your possible adaptations into the future.
Yes. And then the technical working group will be reporting to its work to the Intergovernmental Committee on Climate Change and the National Committee on Climate Change to be part of the broader structure. Based on what you said now, like I indicated earlier on, that the list is not exclusive. We'll have to also engage other sector departments and other sectors that might not have been identified by the policy with regard to climate change adaptation to get them involved. You have cited transport, you have cited energy as an example. Probably there might even be more than those that have been identified by the policy. So they will have also to participate. Like Treasury as an example, it was not picked up by the policy, but they are doing some quite important work in terms of the impact of climate change on the economy of South Africa, so which is the work that actually needs to be.
And train the industry. I mean, new manufacturing processes, what standards we set for cars, what standards we set, you know. Clearly, trade industry has huge place also in adaptation.
Honourable Chair, if I may just respond. Also, just to say that it's true that the line between mitigation and adaptation is not always clear. But I think when we talk about adaptation, we're talking about adaptation to the impact of climate change. So it's, for example, in infrastructure, if in the case of roads, we're finding that the increased intensity of rainstorms results in a shorter life duration of the tarmac, for example. In that, we would need to be making sure that our design and building of roads is able to accommodate that if going into the future we're expecting an increased intensity of heavy thunder showers. I mean, that's an example. But of more obvious examples, probably in respect of infrastructure, might be where there is infrastructure that is particularly prone to or is located in areas that may be flooded. So there we would need to be looking at the infrastructure department being aware of what in the future might be a particular vulnerability or a particular challenge to their infrastructure and therefore adapting. In the case of, for example, energy efficiency standards or renewable energy, those, to some extent, though, in fact, those we would park or categorize more as the mitigation type of response, simply because those responses would result in lower emissions or in emission reductions. So that's why, the closeness or the relationship between adaptation and sustainable development is particularly close. Because we're saying, well, we've got to really take into consideration a whole set of factors going into the future, including possible changes in climatic circumstances.
Look, you give me a perfect explanation, and I know that's how we've done it. But this is the conundrum. This is the conundrum. Mitigation. We know how particularly the developing world feels about mitigation. We feel it's imposition. We feel it's something we have to do because the rest of the world messed up. Now we have to mitigate, and so on and so on and so on. We know the negative connotation. Now the problem is, if you theoretically put the most important areas where you have to move on things, you put that under the negative, and you only put it under the negative, under the mitigation part, that breeds a way of thinking that is wrong. That's all I'm saying. So what the adaptation will be in energy and so on is not, we can't say now yet. But the point is, if you don't have it as part of your work program, then clearly we're not going to move to those new technologies, those ways of actually doing things that will adapt to climate change, in terms of the way we build factories. innovation thinking on these things. That's all I'm trying to say. What it should be at this stage is up in the air. So I fully accept all the answers you've given. I just think there's a mindset change that we need to take a step upwards in terms of long-term scenarios. You have to include those as adaptation. Otherwise, the biggest part of our problem, we're not doing new thinking on it. We're thinking, how do we deal with it in terms of mitigation, which is trying to, you know, achieve certain goals. So that's really my issue. Without in any way not agreeing with what you're saying. But go on with the input.
Yeah. So the composition will be basically be made of government, civil society, organized labor, organized business, adaptation network, state-owned research institutions, and mainly experts from this body, including those departments that you have mentioned. Part of the work that has been directed by the policy wants us to do what we call policy alignment. So it outlines a risk-based process to identify and prioritize short and medium-term adaptation interventions to be addressed in government department sector plans. Wants us to do a gap analysis process that should be carried out to review alignment of sector policies, legislation, and plans with climate change policy in general. And with due respect, if I pick up one sector policy that I have looked into, which probably might be of interest, for an example, the health policy, I didn't mention even one word about climate change. Important that, you know, vector-borne diseases, malaria, creeping into places where it was never there before. So there needs to be an alignment of some sort in terms of sector policies, legislation, and so on. Now, the objective of the policy alignment work is basically to conduct a gap analysis in the identified sectors. Now, we'll have to include some of those that might have been left out by the policy, taking into consideration the comments that have been made by the chair. And then once we have done a policy gap analysis, based on the results of that, to recommend proposals to sector departments on the alignment of the policies to the climate change policy. And this is a very important piece of work which basically will align all of us as a country into the right direction. So I've basically indicated that there's the LTAS process, there's a policy alignment work, and then once we have done that that work, we have to synthesize the two pieces of work and come up with prioritization of short-term and long-term responses to adaptation. And then which will have an integrated impact cost adaptation assessment, and then and including cross sectoral, like for an example, water would cut across all the sectors, most of the sectors, and then do policy alignment. So that is it in terms of the long term adaptation scenario. I've got a piece of work that I need to present.
Oh, yes, you said the toolkit.
But maybe what I need to do, let me leave Professor. I need to do this presentation. I'll do it later because he's doing the work that part of it relates to the LTA.
Okay. You can fit it in there, or you can fit it in when we have provincial and local government coming in talking about that. So we can fit it in wherever you think it's best, okay? All right, that's a very useful input. Any comments, questions? It gives us an overview of where they're going again, the methodology they're following with dealing with this, and obviously it'll take into consideration the comments we make here about it. Ms. Wenger?
Thank you, Chair. Just for a point of clarity, I would like to know, the task team, the technical working group, basically, is there to align to oversee and monitor I'd like to know whether the international rules and standards are identical to the simplest that we have stipulated in the next slide, or is it our own adaptation? We, the industry, infrastructure, and as you mentioned, energy and transport fit into any of those columns on the international standards. And if it is stated there on the international, why is it not mentioned in ours? And if it isn't mentioned on the international, what are the reasons that it's overarching internationally versus nationally? Why it's left off?
Any other comments, questions, clarity? Okay. Respond to that.
There's an international panel on climate change, which basically set international standards. It might be of scenarios that we want to use, how to do that, the types of modeling that we want to use. I'm not sure if I got the question correctly, Jack. Is the question why are they not part of the technical working group or okay?
Is the same standards that are set internationally that we are using, or do we have our own standards?
No.
Does it relate to those three strategies that you mentioned? I think that's it. But maybe you want to just clarify this, Sue.
Thanks. The international rules and standards, are they identical to the three columns that you have, the economic sector, the social sector, and the natural resources sector? Because none of those, if you have page 6, the bottom slide.
I just answered, sir.
Good morning, colleagues, and thanks for the question. By character, adaptation has always been is localized. Adaptation is not is most of the time a response to something that has taken place in at a local setup. So our work in the department is going to be informed by domestic circumstances, by domestic priorities. Our actions, our responses are going to be informed by domestic circumstances. Indeed, internationally there's work going on, and we are aware, actually we are participating in that work. In this room we've got people that are participating in IPCC chapters that address adaptation. In short, our approach is domestic in character, is taking into account domestic actions and domestic responses. Two, we are aware and we are participating in international adaptation work, and we are learning lessons and best practices internationally, both within the UN context and outside the UN bodies. And that process, we are giving inputs in those processes, and we are learning lessons from those processes.
So we will take the examples internationally, but we'll adapt it and use it, and we will create our own local norms and standards and so on. Does that answer? I think that answers, yeah.
Yeah, and if you look, Chair, into the first line on the papers that I presented earlier on, you say most of the work would be dependent on the latest range of the IPCC A2, which is an international panel on climate change, but also then the other comments that have been made by Dr. Montana would be applicable.
This issue I've raised, you know, is another way also I want to demonstrate you so you understand what I'm saying. if you start looking at things like energy and transport and so on, in terms of best practices, in terms of let us respond to what climate change is doing in our area, what is the best way to respond to it, then renewable energy becomes a very viable thing, not because we're trying to deal with climate change, but renewable energy is the right thing to do. So you see, that's the mind change we need, and it helps with a whole lot of things that I think it's important. That, and as I say, I'm not here able to say to you, well, I mean, energy and transport, these are the kind of adaptation things. But for me, renewable energy is exactly, I mean, I don't only think that renewable energy is important and we should expand it rapidly because we want to respond to climate change. I think it's the right thing to do, and it fits into much better in the whole idea of sustainable development. That's why I want it, which is exactly what adaptation is all about. So you see, that's why I'm saying we mustn't lock ourselves into a paradigm that only puts certain responses as mitigation to climate change. Because if you do that, you will fight an uphill battle every step of the way. Whereas if you start saying to people, which Mark Swilling does, and said there have been five waves of development, there's now the sixth wave. Forget climate change. We don't want to do this for climate change. Do it because you want a winning nation. And the quicker you get on the new wave of technology, the better and more successful you'll become as a nation. So it's another way of thinking that climate change fits into that. It fits into sustainable development. And not the other way around, where we can easily lock ourselves into the more negative kind of scenario. So those are the things. All right, well, what I do think we should do, if there's no questions and comments, I do think this document we should also, after you guys have done your consultations about the things I've said now, I don't expect you just to put it in. I mean, you would want to look at it and see how it fits in. But I do think this document must then be adapted. At the very least, that first question I asked, the reality now and the long term, how do we make sure that the document reflects, we're trying to get the two parallel and then get them into one, and that's not reflected. And then this other issue that has been raised around these other adaptations. So this document must also then be adapted in time, so we have a more full response. All right, is that... everyone happy with this input? This document will be further updated in terms of the two responses we've done. Okay. All right, let's get to the first department. Who is it today? It's Sandy. Dr. Mitchell, come to the front here so you're close to me so I can just give swipes if I don't like what you're saying. The quickest way to deal with the freedom of expression.
Of the research program. engaging in the rollout of that program. Of course, there's always some space for fine-tuning the program, and we'd certainly be open to that. And in fact, we've designed a process to enable that to happen. So let me jump straight to, I think Mr. Maremi gave a very good outline of what we're about. But so I want to get to some specifics and some specifics on the actions that we're undertaking. So we have, as I said, designed a program, and we have a detailed proposal already submitted for final funding approval from a funder to roll the program out over a very short time frame. We really want to move fast on this program. The proposal, and I'll outline what it is that the proposal undertakes to do, because it gives a sense of what we really, the actions that we're going to do. It addresses 8 key sectors, and you'll see some of them are clustered. So the first sector, agriculture, forestry and fisheries, human health, water, human settlements, urban, rural and coastal, ecosystems and biodiversity, and then this area of disaster risk reduction and disaster management. Of course, all these sectors are not at the same stage of readiness with regard to climate change adaptation. We can't expect them all to be at the same stage. Something like disaster risk reduction and management, obviously well advanced. We have policies on the table. We have approaches. We have national institutions to deal with that. Ecosystems and biodiversity, we're fairly well down the road, but there are some which are much further behind. So we have to design a process that brings all of these sectors together so that we can end up with a more coherent view of adaptation and what it is that we're currently doing and what we want to do, how we use the stuff that's currently going on to build a coherent national approach. The detailed proposal that we've put forward aims to achieve the following flagship focus deliverables, with a real focus on usable products, especially maps for at all relevant spatial scales. Firstly, we need to understand the climate scenarios. What do we expect from climate over the short, medium, and long term? What sort of risks do we have, for example, over the next decade? Of a significant drought. We know that we've had droughts in the past. We've had floods. What are the risks of these things over the short term? And that speaks to the disaster risk reduction and management area, but it's also the area of agriculture, water, are obviously critically dependent on things like short-term changes in climate variability mainly. Over the medium and long term, we're getting more into the sort of traditional view of climate change. But as Dr. Montana said, we have the opportunity to drive our own process, a country-driven process. If you look in the negotiations internationally, there's a strong focus on a country-driven process. We need to design a process that fits our local circumstances, our capacities, our needs, and South Africa is prone to short-term climate variability, droughts and floods. And we've seen what that can do, and we need to build that into our process. A national assessment of the potential impacts and costs on sectors. Now, we have an idea from earlier work, such as summarized in the second national communication, on what these might be. But what we really need to do is to build a much more coherent picture. That was one of the big learnings from the second national communication process, is we need a more coherent view. The different sectors have been using slightly different climate scenarios, for example. It's very difficult to compare what are the priorities in the different sectors? How do we judge which sectors are most at risk from the information that we currently have? We need to build a process to get a better sense. It doesn't mean that we can't do anything now and we have to do things now, but for future, it would be much better. We'd be on a much better footing if we understood the relative risk to sectors much better. An assessment of adaptation options and their feasibility, very important. I've seen so much theoretical work on what sort of adaptation options you could do, and it's just, it would not apply. It's too theoretical. It would not apply. So, and our processing involves engaging stakeholders to really test the feasibility of options, to understand what they're doing already, and to test the feasibility of options. The assessment of costs of implementation of the options and the benefits that could flow from that implementation. Get a sense of where are the big hits, where are the lowest cost, the biggest benefits, where could we prioritize those sorts of adaptation strategies. And especially with linkages with mitigation, as you said, Chia, I mean, it's an excellent point, is to try and get the mindset that this makes sense now anyway, especially given South Africa's vulnerability to climate variability. This makes sense now. An assessment of the regional vulnerability. So South Africa within the region, what does climate change over these time frames imply for the South African situation? What would happen if we have significant droughts in the region? How would that feedback on South Africa, and how could South Africa help, and how might South Africa suffer harm from that? And then finally, the development of useful products. So we want a range of useful products that flow out of this process, and as soon as possible. We don't want to wait until right at the end. We want to have these products flow out as soon as possible. So the process that we're going to roll out, and we've already held our first workshop, and we're having another workshop on the 19th. Of June, so our second workshop, which is engaging stakeholders, is that SAMBI will coordinate the national level expert teams to conduct the assessments and the analysis. The departments, so it's a close collaboration, the department's going to coordinate a stakeholder engagement process, and this process is designed to do two main things: inform stakeholders and provide guidance where appropriate, but also very importantly, gather information from stakeholders, because we're not, everybody's an expert at their local level, and we need to tap into that local knowledge. And we want to leverage that experience to maximize the relevance and the feasibility of adaptation responses. Keep it real, not theoretical. So that's what that's designed to do. And those two processes are going to run in parallel with good project management to ensure a meaningful coordination between those two processes. It's a challenge, short time frame, but I think we've got a good plan on the table. Having said that, this is the proposed timeline of the project. You can see it may look like a long time to some of you, but to the scientists among us, one gets a bit tense looking at this sort of thing. But over the next couple of years, this is the sort of thing that we want to roll out. The W's and the R's there represent stakeholder workshops and reports that are due, and how those are integrated and designed to give a first phase product at the end of this financial year. So, the climate modelling and analysis, which underpins everything, is in fact already underway. Impacts modelling and adaptation, economic cost modelling, the sub-regional assessment, and then an integrated piece of work which starts halfway through, which brings all these ideas together. That cross-sectoral integration is extremely important. As an example, not only cross-sectoral with regard to adaptation, but cross-sectoral with regard to mitigation. Think about water and the water constraints that this country really finds itself in. Coal-fired power generation is very dependent on water. Agriculture, hugely dependent on water. 50% almost of our water, surface water, goes to irrigation. A climate future with less water in the offing, what do we do? We've also got a growing population which is going to demand more water. So these are things that make sense anyway. We've got to look at an integrated response that deals with the mitigation, the vulnerability of the energy generation to water restrictions, plus food security through the agriculture sector, plus urban settlements. We've seen in the past where water's been constricted, the kind of health impacts that has. It's very, very damaging. So in many ways, this program looks at current vulnerabilities and the actions that are underway to reduce those vulnerabilities as well. So it's a win-win-win kind of thing that we're trying to go for. So that's how we'd like to roll it out. And as I said, we have funding very close to available. And where we want to end up, and this is just a little selection of the sorts of places we'd like to end up, we want a more coherent view of South Africa's vulnerabilities in the context of the region over the short, medium, and long term, including an economic view of that, because that really speaks to a big sector of society. If you can give an economics numbers as well, look, that's not the be all and the end all. The reason a lot of adaptation options don't look viable is because they're relevant to poor people. And the impacts on poor people don't emerge in an economics analysis because poor people don't have a lot of financial resources. And that's incredibly inequitable. So we, you know, it can't only be economics. It's also got to be about people and the impacts on people. A credible set of products that informs and guides adaptation options, toolkits and approaches, vulnerability maps, as Mr. Marenghi said, through the Risk and Vulnerability Atlas, we have this venue that we can use already. We really want to try and achieve an effective network of adaptation research, practitioners and management stakeholders, people talking to each other, learning, ongoing learning about adaptation, because this is a learning by doing process in many, many ways, who are more aligned. There's lots of stuff going on. It's reactive. We want to turn adaptation from a reactive into a proactive, anticipatory process much more. Of course, the reactive stuff will always have to continue because you can't predict everything. But if we could make it more anticipatory, we could use resources more efficiently and financial and human resources more efficiently. And we want to end up with a knowledge base. Very importantly, this is more a strategic climate change negotiating position issue. We want to know how appropriate the 2-degree global goal is for South Africa's well-being. We have an idea of that. We don't have a really well pinned down idea. That will strengthen South Africa's negotiating position substantively in the international negotiations. If we knew that 2 degrees globally meant 3.5 degrees nationally, and that meant the destruction of South Africa's agricultural sector, that would give us enormous political will to do something on the international stage, to work with our partners in the G77, to argue for a more coherent or stronger global goal with our African partners. Very, very important. So that's one of the outcomes of the long-term modelling that we want to do is what are the different emissions pathways mean for South Africa from an adaptation vulnerability perspective. So that's the last piece that I have to say. Thanks very much once again for listening.
Right, this looks very good. Comments, questions? This is obviously a flagship that's now being put into operation. It's starting to move at least. General?
Thank you, Chairperson. If I am a person who is living somewhere near an arid set of area, land, or let me say in a rural area, and you are talking about the funding which is available, what comes to my mind is that money will end up in the urban areas. Western Bush areas and any other areas. Yet, you are my government. But can you unpack this practically as to how will this be cascaded to those people in those areas? Have you got pilot programs? Or will just be looking at the garden route? Only this area.
feelings about sort of the quality or availability of courses at a tertiary level in South Africa, which are feeding into these processes? I mean, it's a massive challenge, this, exciting and equally important. So the one is, I mean, how much is it being specifically offered, adaptation, and to what extent at a tertiary or whatever level, FET level, should adaptation actually become part of any number of other different disciplines? Because there are so many different disciplines in South Africa that are going to require adaptive learning processes and the ability to analyze models and change systems, whether it be in water or local government or disaster management or agriculture or the like. Are you seeing those changes? Are those discussions the type of discussions that are going on? In essence, are we going to a place where we are all, those of us who come out of sort of tertiary study, be able to gauge in some sense with the concept of adaptation, both philosophical and real?
Anyone else? What excites me about this is that I can see that this can become the sharpest knife in the government's climate change drawer. But it can also become what the general says. You know, when it comes to research and to academics and things like that, that Dr. mentioned and so on, they have all interesting projects, but they've got nothing to do with reality and with the real world and so on. All in their head. And so, although it has got that potential, I mean, you know, this is absolutely amazing to look at the national assessment of the sector, the national assessment of the options and feasibility. That's exactly what we need, because that'll give the government that sharp tool to, when all these departments come with all their programs for money, that one can give an assessment and say, okay, well, it's a good program, but it's going to cost 10 billion rand, it's only going to provide us this kind of risk aversion to climate change. So I can see that. But two questions flow from that. Where do you get your mandate from? In other words, you know, where are your priorities going to be to fit in again with what the general is saying? Is it going to be the things that impact in the old Transkei, the old Bantustans, where the poorest of the poor live and so on, and that, or not? So the mandate, I imagine part of your mandate comes from this department, but you're now fitting into a bigger ship. I think I also saw that you were part of the technical committee. But so where will you get the mandate to push the right topics so that we're getting the right information for the right decisions to be made? Where will that mandate come from? The second issue, which is an obvious one, and I imagine you have an answer for it. You know, we have a whole, here we're now creating research and so on. It's great. It's a lovely project. But then we have a whole chapter in the white paper that deals with the people that were here yesterday, science and technology. They have to set up structures for research and so on. How do the two fit into each other? And how are we going to avoid huge overlaps and later on turf battles? Because, I mean, I can see this already with the white paper giving a particular task to science and technology, pull all these people together and so on, and we doing this. So that whole area of how we're going to make sure that they fit into each other, they don't overlap, but more importantly, don't work against each other. Those are a whole lot of questions. There may be more. Let's get some responses.
Well, thanks for a really useful set of questions and comments. To Honourable Polomisa, you know, your point is very well taken, and I think I really try to stress the reason economics is important, but not be all and end all. It's precisely what you're talking about. My colleague, Mr. Moremi, will talk about the municipal toolkits. It's going to be one of the main ways of rolling this out, the benefits out to the people that you're referring to. You know, we've long said climate change is a poverty issue. The poverty is one of those preconditions that makes climate change
all the more damaging. So this has to be a major priority. So we can't only focus on the garden route and the Kirstenbosches of the world. That's not going to work. And then the question about the tertiary element. I think, Chair, it also refers to your point. Is this how's the science being integrated? How are the academics being produced? The new skills that are coming through. I think DST presented yesterday on the Applied Centre for Climate and Earth System Science. We have a presentation, I think, going on elsewhere today on the National System of Innovation of the DST, which talks about the Global Change Grant Challenge. These are all science programs which are trying to build a national capacity in a new area of study, which academics are starting to really come to terms with multidisciplinary science. This is a kind of a multidisciplinary science. You can't afford, as you so rightly said, theoretical scientists with specializing in one discipline doing this kind of work. It doesn't work. So this country is embarking on an amazing set of new innovative training programs under the Global Change Grant Challenge, under ACCESS. ACCESS is training more than 100 new postgraduate students with a strong focus on previously disadvantaged society, community. You know, people who will really be able to have the perspectives that will drive the kind of concerns that we've heard expressed here today. So this new group of 100, it's more than 100, MSCs and PhDs are going to be coming into our capacity, our system, and will be able to be taken up into the new programs that are going to roll out, the new jobs, the new green economy, which is going to involve adaptation response. Adaptation response is going to be part of the new economy. So I think there's a really promising sort of synergy going on between the science and the innovation system in the country and the kind of practical work that we're trying to do here. And these two are actually supporting each other quite well now. So I'm enormously optimistic about what happens over the next decade in terms of new capacity coming out with exactly the right kind of training and perspectives that we're going to need to roll this out. Mandate-wise, I'm not sure I'm the right person to be answering that question. I wasn't sure what... maybe I misunderstood. Chair, maybe you could rephrase the question about the mandate.
Well, ultimately, it's the same question you're answering now. When you decide which teams of scientists to put together, or you ask people to research certain things, if you are part of a program of government to deal with climate change, who will give you your priorities and so on? So, in other words, is SANBI going to sit there in the air and decide, well, this is what we're going to do, and so on? Or are you going to get your mandate from the technical committee, which you are part of? Or will you get it from the interministerial committee? Will you get it from the Department of DEA? I mean, when you're setting up this whole program, that has to be in the forefront of what we're thinking. I mean, it has to be part of how this thing's going to work. Exactly, because of the next question I asked about the conflict. Because you've got access, you've got science and technology, you've got all these things happening. A lot of money has been pumped into how to deal with climate change. But how are we going to maximize this to really make it the sharpest knife in the drawer? Because if we're saying that things are science-based and evidence-based, then clearly you do become the sharpest knife in the drawer. But if you go on a tangent and we don't get the right kind of information, the right priority, etc., etc., and it is not part of achieving the goals that the structures we've set up in government for climate change to achieve, then that can become a problem in itself. So that's really the question. Not, I think you know what I'm asking.
I understand. Thanks, Honourable Chair. You know, I think that part of what is very exciting about this piece of work is that it is bringing together the priorities of different departments and different research institutions. Now, of course, in an absolutely ideal world, we would have a perfectly defined vision and set of objectives for the next 10, 20 years for the research that needs to happen. But in reality, we've got directives, mandates, and policy directives coming from different policies that are sitting under different departments or are being driven, the implementation of which is being driven by different departments. DST is one of them, but equally we have work that is being driven by the ARC, which gets its mandate from the Department of Agriculture. We have work being driven by the Water Research Commission, which obviously has a link with the Department of Water Affairs. So the key issue about this work, and to some extent similar in nature to the approach that is being adopted in the mitigation work, is to start slowly but surely bringing these different pieces of research direction, policy direction, and practical work, most critically, bring all of these bits together in a directed and clearly defined direction, which we are starting to put together from this long-term adaptation scenario work. And I think what's also important is that last year, the first step in the adaptation implementation work was for departments to lead their own or to take leadership in putting together a first draft of what adaptation within that particular sector would mean. So we have a set of very first draft adaptation plans for water affairs, for agriculture, for a whole set of departments, one for biodiversity was also included, rural development, health did their own one. And I think that was a startup process which started identifying where the research gaps are. It also started identifying and pulling together the work that is already being done and needs to be done further. And that piece of work obviously needs to be refined in the iteration of this planning process. Once we have come up with a really clear direction, as Tepo and Guy have indicated, of what adaptation is needed within those particular sectors going forward, we would need to then come back and come up with a very clearly defined set of adaptation plans per sector. Now, the link with the research is a process, it's an unfolding process in the sense that we are working with Department of Science and Technology, understanding where their global change research can be brought in, leveraged in to this work that we're doing. Work that's being done by the WRC, work that's being done by ARC and various others, work that Sandy is doing, in fact. Very interesting work on the impact, the biome adaptation framework, yes. And so it's really about, I wouldn't say herding cats, but it's about pulling together and seeking coherence among the various pieces of research and implementation that is happening in the context of adaptation and in the context of a set of different actors and a set of different departments with their own policy mandates and our climate change policy mandate.
Any comments, follow-up, Geno? It's getting interesting. I think, Chairperson, there is a problem here. I think the government must lead on this one. There is still a need to integrate the areas of South Africans, especially on the issue of the infrastructure. The homelands and some townships are still living under the old arrangement. And the infrastructure to those areas is lagging far behind. And this is an opportunity now when we correct those imbalances that the department and your work as scientist is at the center stage. For instance, when you go to these rural areas, some people will tell you that there were trees here, there was fruit. fruit trees here, all the ecosystems were here, birds and so on. But because of poverty, they chopped down those trees, and the birds migrated. And there is a need to just, when you do the research, don't use computers only. Just get out, go to those villages, go to Gazangul. How have you been successful here? How did you fight poverty and so on? Go to areas like Transkei. How are you managing to sustain this wild coast all along without even one line of fencing? So you need that indigenous knowledge. But the key, how do you integrate the old homelands and townships into the first world infrastructure of the old South Africa, where, for instance, if you drive between Joburg and Durban, you'll find that those animals drink cleaner water than those people in the townships.
I think it is important that we, what we're saying is that I think what we must do, Dr. Mitchley, is in designing this, we must clearly make a focus at the very least that the work that is being done must particularly focus on the vulnerable, the poor, and the da da da. I think I will feel much more. You see, I know, and you, the way you talk, I know you're that kind of person. I know you look at those issues, and I know that you. But the problem is, there's a big difference when it comes to research, to actually going out of your way to say, but now how does this affect those parts of our country? I mean, if you want to respond to climate change, I mean, the thing that the general is saying, although it's ordinary life and ordinary governance, but it's actually important for climate. Whether you have proper roads, whether you have proper communication systems and so on, for people to be able to, so they can respond the same way as we in the city can respond. Must have the ability. So I really think that from our perspective will be important that you make that part of your design of this thing, to have part of it to say very clearly that in doing any piece of research, specific attention and focus has to be paid on how these policies or these adaptations will actually assist the vulnerable, the poor, and so on. So I think that will be an important part of it. There's another issue I want to raise, but let me first as a follow up. Dr. Juan? I also, before I get there, our researcher says that this book that he's just given me very kindly, which I'm not going to give back to him, called Towards a Low Carbon City, Focus on Durban. A lot of these issues the general that is raising is apparently in this book. It's done by the Academy of Science of South Africa. So apparently this is quite interesting to look at, how they do this. But as I said, this is my copy, so bear that. Dr. Juan.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's from the Sunday presentation, your program about action. You already have the funding from the GEMA is international cooperation. I'd like to know how much funding you have from the international funding. Also, for your position, you say you also coordinate with the national level. Because a lot of the other speakers say is for your research, each department is different. The DEA also for the research, and South Africa Water Service also for the research. So everyone for the research, then how we combine? Because yesterday the presentation said this structure get for the consultation structure and the implementation structure. From the Sambi side, you are the partner to this IGCCC and the NCCC. This one is more important from your side. So we can more clear say this funding, how you utilize for your action this program. Okay.
Any other comments, questions? All right, let's respond to that and we'll wrap up.
Thanks. So that's useful question. What we have is a proposal which is in the between 5 and 6 million for the entire project. and earlier workers, you know, we've developed some good partnerships and some good relationships with the people who the teams that are able to do this work. We're also deeply engaged in the development of the Global Change Grant Challenge and in Access. So we've provided the kind of the guidance to ensure that these programs start to align much better with national priorities in the climate change area. So in a sense, I think that's why Sandy has been mandated to do this work, because of this historical, the building up of this historical capacity in our institute. So I hope that answers the question sufficiently. I just want to say, this is the discussion we had just prior to that, really indicates the huge opportunity in climate change, that it gives so much more impetus into the sustainable development, the value of sustainable development. Climate change gives it an additional value. So, I like to see climate change as a massive opportunity and try to downplay the threats, because we can avoid those threats, but we can really benefit from the opportunities now and try and see it in that light. I think we've been talking along those lines today. I think it makes all the sense.
The best way to do that is to link what we're doing there to other things that we should be doing in any case, because that's the right thing to do. The one thing I do think needs to be done, though, Ms. Beaumont, doctor, the other doctor, is I do think sooner than later, I think you must sit down with the other persons, particularly science and technology, who's given a particular task, and sit down and talk through these things. Yesterday when science and technology were here, it's clear that in their thinking, they're still right in the beginning of this. Now, the last thing you want to do is start setting up duplicate structures and so on and so on. Rather find ways now, where, as they are thinking about it, how to give them their role they have to play, but how does all this fit together? So there needs to be some creative thinking and so on, because no one even gives up turf very easily. We all know that. So I really think it's one of the tasks the committee would want you to do, is that to really meet very early on this and sort out the parameters and the kind of areas of work and see how that thing's going to work together. But as I say, if we do it right, this can become the sharpest tool. If we do it wrong, it can bedevil us, because you can then start getting reports from more than one source in government, and they could be contradicting each other, and that could create havoc in terms of policy, in terms of doing things. If there's one line of thought coming from one place, another line of thought coming from another place. So we would really ask on the governance issues you meet early now, and that hopefully this will all be ready and sorted out by the next time we meet. But I want to say I think there's good work being done, excellent. Some of the areas you concentrate on are absolutely vital for the success of some of these projects. So well done. Thank you.
All right. I mean, this place, you just talk a little bit, you drink a lot of coffee. So your chance to drink a lot of coffee again is here. There's coffee outside. I wouldn't suggest you must eat the food, but I suggest go drink the coffee. 5 minutes. Thank you. Thank you very much. Who's next? Water is next, so get ready, please. Around two. Yeah. And, yeah, I think
Laptops.
Yes.
When I
arrive,
you just
look. But I can just only.
Maybe the back there.